Hi, this is John Hockenberry, and speaking to someone who clearly loves to listen at the time of their choosing, you should give the WNYC app a try, you know? Not only can you listen to this program, but it'll also automatically search for the kinds of stories and subjects you like. It's really cool, and it's free. There are other apps and radio stations available, but thanks for listening. Here's today's program. It's The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And it's an old story and a very new story. Someone flies from Africa to Europe to Texas, spends a few days in a community of West Africans in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, begins to feel ill, and it's as simple as that. This hour, a portrait of a small world. When the Ebola crisis in West Africa can land undetected here in the USA, we will begin with the latest from Dallas and conclude today with a look at the broader numbers that show how much this country is a 330 million person model of the diversity worldwide. If you do America by the numbers, you see a changing land of shifting and growing communities from West Africa, South America, Asia, from sea to shining sea, from California to the Gulf Stream waters. That and much more this hour, but we begin in Dallas. A man whose name we now know is Thomas Duncan is in the intensive care unit and isolation of a Dallas hospital infected with Ebola. He is someone whose contact with dozens of people in the Dallas area, we now know, has triggered a number of precautionary measures. About 20 people are known to have been in contact with that man diagnosed with Ebola, including 5 school children, and the Dallas Independent School District has set up a hotline providing parents with relevant information about Ebola.
It is important to know that individuals are not contagious until symptoms appear. Therefore, there is no imminent danger to your child. We are working with the Dallas County Health and Human Services Department and will continue monitoring this development and will provide updated information.
That is a recording there in Dallas. We will talk to the superintendent of schools in the independent school district. Thomas Duncan, who reportedly flew to the United States from Liberia, has told investigators that he had helped transport a pregnant woman infected with Ebola to the hospital, then back home where she died. He arrived at Texas Health Presbyterian Hospital earlier this week with a fever. He told hospital officials he had traveled from West Africa, but that detail was overlooked. And Mr. Duncan was sent home and came into contact with the people, including those school children, who are being watched closely today. Dwali Saikautaut, senior reporter for KERA in Dallas, Texas, has been covering this story. Welcome.
Hi there.
So what are we learning about the behavior of the hospital and the whereabouts of this individual, Mr. Thomas Duncan?
At this point, the focus is really on the children who had direct contact with this Ebola patient, and they're not showing symptoms of Ebola, fever, vomiting, or diarrhea, and that's what's important. And officials said they were monitoring them, but this morning, state officials sent out an order, and this order apparently was given to them last night and orders them to stay at home with no visitors unless it's pre-approved. And this legally requires the family to remain at home for 21 days. That's how long the risk is of developing any symptoms. But again, how they'll do this is a big question because it comes down to enforcement. Will police stand in front of their home to prevent neighbors from visiting or stop the children from playing in the yard? So that's really the focus right now.
There's a lot of rules in the rule book that are going to have to be written by this incident here. And you're hearing that in some of the questioning of hospital officials at Texas Health Presbyterian Hospital. This individual voluntarily came to the hospital, indicated to a nurse that he'd actually been in Liberia, but that information wasn't transmitted up the chain, and he actually went away for a while. What is the questioning of hospital officials, and how worried are they that he might have had more contact than would have been permitted if the protocol had been followed?
Correct. Hospital officials admitted to this yesterday that a nurse had asked these questions, did learn that he was from Liberia, but that failed to, you know, get to those up in the higher chains of command. Now, there are a lot of lessons taking place here. A lot of people are basically learning as they go. And so it's really just a huge map, a lot of coordination, but part of the concern here is where this man was, which was in Northeast Dallas, in the neighborhood of Vickery Meadow. You know, it's a very diverse community. We're talking about 30 languages in that neighborhood. It's very complex. And the reaction from a lot of the folks were, well, you know, calm, Some are trusting that the doctors and medical professionals can handle this. They're aware that two Americans survived Ebola because of the care that they received here in the U.S., but others are scared, especially the refugee or immigrant communities that are seeing helicopters flying around, cameras snapping around fences, you know, apartments and local eateries. But, you know, from the federal to the state to the city to the hospitals, everybody's got an emergency operation running. So it's really quite complex.
Two things, Dwali. Is there a sizable Liberian community in the Dallas area and in the neighborhood that you're talking about?
Yes, there is, both in Dallas and in nearby Arlington. There's a lot of churches that obviously help and support the community, and they've actually been doing a lot of work to support those in Liberia who have already been affected by Ebola. So the focus, again, comes back to educating those who don't understand Ebola and trying to help parents understand what this really means for them and their children.
And educating people to give them the correct facts to compete with the rumor mill, of course, in the community, as you describe, is really on edge. Finally, before we go, I heard yesterday that Mr. Duncan was in, and we didn't know his name at that point, was in critical condition. Now they're saying serious but stable. Any sense that he's getting better, he's getting worse? Any idea of his condition right now?
All we know at this time is that he's stable, an improvement from an earlier diagnosis that was described as critical. But how doctors define his current condition, serious but stable, varies, and it can change any hour. Presbyterian says they're giving him the best care possible. It would be a different story if he were back home in Liberia.
But he is in isolation and in the intensive care unit there at Texas Health Presbyterian Hospital in Dallas-Fort Worth. Dwali Saikautau, thank you so much.
Thanks.
Dwali Saikautau is a senior reporter for KERA in Dallas. Superintendent Mike Miles of the Dallas Independent School District spoke with us about the details of the mission to get quality information to parents and families.
There's two main priorities. One, of course, is always safety first, safety of our children and our community. And then the second one is to provide information. And so yesterday we spent a lot of time just informing the public about what was going on, and today is the same thing. We just want to reassure people our schools are safe, and we want to get kids in school and doing the work that we need to do every day.
Now, what do you say to parents who call up and say, I don't want my kids coming to school, or if I do, I don't want them in a class with any of those immigrants, Superintendent Miles? What would you say to a parent who had those concerns?
Well, the first thing I would say is that the school is safe. School is operating today. We'll see in a moment, but we think most kids will be there. Our staff will be there. And then we're going to give them more information about how you can't contract the disease unless you are in contact with somebody who has symptoms, for example. I think parents who hear that will feel more assured. We're going to make sure that we have extra nurses on hand. We did yesterday. We will today. So if they have any questions about the disease, but any questions about their child's health or the risk, they can go see an actual person, not just get online to look at some FAQ. And that will be hopefully reassuring. We've done extra cleaning of the classrooms, even though we do that every day. The Ebola virus is not a hardy virus. We don't think there is any virus in the schools. But just to take that off the table for parents, we sent an extra crew to each of the five schools.
Finally, do you have challenges getting your message into certain neighborhoods and communities that are maybe more closed than individuals who maybe watch television and pay attention to the mainstream media channels?
Yes, sir. So one of the challenges is the fact that we have 32 different languages spoken in that community where the schools are. So we've translated our messages and information into Arabic, in Burmese, Vietnamese, and several other languages, and we continue to do that. We also have people on the ground who are translators. So we are trying to communicate in as many different ways as we possibly can. We'll be sending out some people to the various apartment complexes trying to get more information out. But that is a challenge.
Superintendent Mike Miles, suspect you have a very busy day today.
Yes.
Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, sir.
The holy city of Mecca has become a Mecca for a commercially glittery building initiative, and unholy to some, by the Saudi government that has changed the city of the Hajj to look more like a theme park mall than a millennium-old cultural site. Did you know that Mecca has the tallest clock tower building in the world, the tallest hotel in the world? As millions of Muslims embark on the pilgrimage to Mecca this week, part of the Hajj, we spoke with Akbar Ahmed, chair of Islamic studies at American University and Pakistan's former ambassador to the United Kingdom. He shared his image of Mecca that's in his heart and what he sees from those aerial shots of Mecca in 2014.
I find the two images quite incompatible, and I find them disturbing because the images of what a lot of Muslims are calling the Las Vegas face of Mecca with all these new developments and the traditional idea of Mecca and the practice of Mecca, the Hajj, and going on pilgrimage, these two are sitting very uneasily together. Mecca, of course, symbolizes for Muslims the holiest of the holy, the idea of a pilgrimage to leave the world behind, a very spiritual place, the heart of Islam. And with these huge building complexes, the luxury hotels, five-star luxury hotels, and now, of course, with the Royal Mecca Clock Tower, which you mentioned, one of the highest, probably the highest building in the world. And it's a very solid, very traditional kind of skyscraper structure with nothing really Islamic about it, towering over the Grand Mosque itself. It is very jarring, the juxtaposition of the images.
And a traditional skyscraper, but certainly no tradition that Muhammad, the prophet, would understand.
Exactly, because like all pilgrimages, whether in Judaism, Christianity, or indeed in non-Abrahamic religions like Hinduism or Buddhism, the idea really is to grapple with your understanding of the divine, to leave the world behind. And the Islamic pilgrim is really in that spirit, so that the pilgrim arrives in Mecca and he is asked to leave all visible signs of the world, which is clothes, which is your watches, your ties, your wallets, everything behind. You just wear a sheet, a white sheet, all men, women, kings, presidents, ordinary people, students. And the result is that you really, for those couple of days, feel that you are as close as you can be to the divine here on earth. And I'm just thinking how one is going to be going through that particular ritual, that particular form of religiosity and sacredness with these huge towers and apartments and hotels looking down on you, and you have no idea what's going on in those buildings because they're all dark and they're tinted.
And let's speak about the legacy of the House of Saud, the royal family that has controlled the holy sites since Saudi Arabia really took control of that area in Ottoman times. Is the legacy a commercialization? Or is the legacy one of reorienting Mecca to be really a place for Salafists, Muslims, Sunni Salafists, who are very, very much in control in Saudi Arabia? And that's not necessarily an orientation of Islam that Shiites would embrace, or many around the world.
Well, John, that's a very important question. And it's obviously a complex question because you have, as I see, two contradictory impulses in the Saudi drive to, let us say, renovate Mecca and Medina. Also, don't forget, Medina is also in their sights. One impulse is coming from the billions and billions of dollars that the Saudis have, and they want to spend this in this lavish, garish, almost vulgar way of wanting to build the tallest, biggest, most modern buildings, number one. And number two, there's the other impulse, which is to express the architecture, the building projects, and through this expression, bring out the essential doctrine of Wahhabism, that is Puritanism, which is the most rigid or the strict form of Islam that you can imagine, which means anything that distracts from the worship of God, including sites directly associated with the Prophet of Islam, that is the origin of faith, they must be removed. So there's talk of removing the Prophet's remains in Medina, in the most famous, in the second most holy site in Islam, in the most famous mosque there, the Mosque of the Prophet. There's already talk of the old buildings in which the Prophet lived and his wife lived, Khadija, and so on. They are being removed. Some parts of them have been demolished, and in the extensions planned for Mecca itself, they're going to just disappear. So for all kinds of archaeological, cultural, heritage, religious reasons, this is going to be a very explosive subject in the coming time.
Thinking about ISIS and the Islamic State that has declared a caliphate centered in the Syrian city of Raqqa, does the Disneyfication of Mecca, does that embolden forces of ISIS to try to delegitimize the Saudi claim on the holy sites? Or does this other impulse, this Wahhabi impulse, encourage the folks from ISIS to actually embrace what's going on in Mecca right now?
Again, a very interesting question, John, and I've thought about it a lot. If you look at not only ISIS, also look at what the Taliban did, if you recall, when they blew up those great, the most incredible treasure of Afghanistan, the Buddhist statues in Bamiyan.
Sure.
Now, again, it's the same impulse, the impulse to destroy anything which is associated with idolatry in the minds of these people. At the same time, these very people will use modern technology, their wealth, to express their philosophy in building and architecture. And you can see that happening in ISIS, where they're destroying the traditional mosques and they're destroying these old shrines and so on. So they are actually already implementing some of this philosophy. This is a much, much deeper struggle, if you like, a spiritual struggle, which takes political forms. That is happening throughout the Muslim world. This is, in fact, if you like, a very intensely internal debate.
And it's certainly something that is beneath the hearts of all of the individuals who are going to Mecca for the Hajj on a year where there are tensions afoot in the Middle East and in the Islamic world. Akbar Ahmed, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
Akbar Ahmed is chair of the Islamic Studies Department at American University and Pakistan's former ambassador to the United Kingdom. There is realistic-looking war on a video game screen. Always a soundtrack, and you see the enemy as you blow him away in Call of Duty Black Ops or other combat video games. And then there is simply real war on a screen.
Hey, Sergeant Max engaging somebody just northwest of the...
Northwest of the house?
Roger.
Footage of a real firefight shot in Afghanistan. No soundtrack, and the enemy is far away, even if the bullets are close at hand. This is from the award-winning documentary Restrepo. The realism of war is something that can be experienced in a game or on the battlefield, and soldiers today often experience both. The popularity of Call of Duty Black Ops among military officers and infantry is one reason why Dave Anthony, our next guest, and a writer and director of Call of Duty, has been asked to actually be a real-life strategic advisor to the Art of Future War project at the Atlantic Council.
I've always been very, very flattered by how many people in the military do actually play our game. And I even heard, this was actually from Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North. He spends a lot of time on bases in both Iraq and Afghanistan. And he sees the guys, you know, playing these games. And he told me very specifically that he believes it improves their situational awareness on the field because they often play the game before they go out.
You know, I'm just wondering if maybe the game metaphor is a problem where you've got these soldiers who are in these situations where tactically in one-on-ones they can inflict huge amounts of damage. But over the long haul, it's kind of hopeless that if all you can do is sit around, blow stuff away that's around you, and call in air support, you don't necessarily end up winning any hearts and minds or making a constructive change, and that, you know, you're caught in this endless tactical battle, which very much is like playing Call of Duty endlessly, day after day, week after week.
I couldn't agree more in terms of the continued strategy of how the military is deployed in this respect. I mean, we're seeing this right now. And one of the big things that I want to try and examine as part of my involvement in Washington is really looking at how fighting wars needs to change. I think the government and the military infrastructure is still stuck very much in the old days. I mean, even go back to World War II, where if there's a problem with someone we need to deal with, then we just send in an army and deal with it. And I look at, you know, what happens in Washington, and it seems to me like it's a very, very reactive system, where very often policies will change, or the government itself will only change as a result of something happening. We have a huge military infrastructure in this country right now. And if you look at some of the potential threats that may be coming to our nation, there is a very high probability of soft targets being attacked in this country. And I wonder, you know, in a similar way to how you might consider an air marshals on flights, where if there's any activity or terrorists, they're in civilian clothing, they carry concealed weapons, not visible weapons, and they are trained to be able to deal with these problems. I wonder if even, you know, US soldiers could be used to protect some of our soft targets as part of their duty.
A lot of soldiers, particularly commanders, really, if they're scoring themselves in combat, it's not really about the objective. It's about coming home with all their men.
Sure.
How difficult is it to simulate something like that so that the score in a game is not the objective associated with the enemy, but it's the objective associated with bringing everybody back alive?
The way we've tried to handle this in the stories that we've done, and I think we've got better at this, is actually portraying the human element in terms of the character development within these stories. And we've even experimented with, you know, shades of gray in this respect, because, you know, you look at enemies all over the world who you go to war with. I mean, the enemies don't think that they're evil. They think, everyone thinks they're a hero. You know, everybody has their own perspective. And we've put a lot of effort into some of the more recent Call of Duty games, where we actually portray the human side of combat.
Dave Anthony is the writer and director of Call of Duty Black Ops 1 and 2, and the newest team member on the Art of Future War project at the Atlantic Council.
I have just called President Obama to congratulate him on his victory.
The GOP, and Mitt Romney in any case, learned about America's new demographics in the 2012 election. White males getting older and richer are far from a majority in American electoral politics. But there are subtler and deeper stories to the population shifts taking place right now or coming soon to a community near you, if not just your community altogether. The Census Bureau estimates that at least by the year 2043, and possibly sooner, the U.S. will be a majority non-white nation. These demographic shifts by then will no longer be hidden by the distortions of the Electoral College map. America by the Numbers is a new country with some new assumptions. America by the Numbers is also a new documentary series hosted by veteran journalist Maria Hinojosa, which debuts tonight on the World Channel and this Saturday on PBS stations. Maria, welcome.
It's great to be back, John.
You know, this seems like the perfect time for this program. I mean, I think there are so many demographic changes taking place. We're going to see some of that play out in 2014, more in 2016. Why did you decide to do this?
You know, John, the whole premise actually is the numbers, right? So people around the country, and at this point I've visited all 50 states, two territories. So I've been seeing this, you know, quote unquote diversity everywhere. But actually to put some numbers behind it and say, look, guys, you know, people talk about this, you know, the tipping point of becoming a majority non-white America in 2043. People kind of look around. They're like, no, we think it's happening kind of sooner. It's actually happening now. So the future is now. But to be able to base the storytelling, the profound complexities behind this demographic change, to be able to base it on numbers, that's why the series was created.
Well, it you say numbers, but there are some great faces and communities here which really tell the tale. Tell me about Clarkston, Georgia. We're going to hear some voices that really do tell the tale of the numbers that you're speaking of.
Right. So because we wanted to start with data, we looked at trying to find the American South actually has experienced the most intense multicultural, quote-unquote, growth, because we don't like these terms, right, but for lack of a better term. So the South has experienced the most intense multicultural growth in the past decade than any other place in the country, and I'm fascinated with this part of the country. So we found, by the numbers, the most diverse square mile in the South, and it is in Clarkston, Georgia, 10 minutes south from Atlanta. It's a refugee relocation spot that basically is like the future of America on steroids, right? Because there are people from, you know, 60 countries, you know, dozens of languages, religious backgrounds, experiences. And everyone is changing. So it's not just the recent arrivals who more than likely will become American citizens and voters and, you know, run for office, as we were able to document. But it's also changing the white Americans who are there and the African Americans who are there too already. I mean, this is a place where the KKK in one of its modern forms was born, just close to Clarkston, Georgia. So that's the backdrop, but really it's about characters, right? So we meet Graham Thomas, who was studied at Juilliard, you know, but calls Northerners like us, like me, you know, and I'm a Mexican, he calls me a Yankee. And he went to KKK rallies when he was a kid because that was what you did for fun. But he's a jazz-trained Juilliard musician. Well, he doesn't like all the change that's going on around there. He feels really left out. He doesn't understand it all.
People that came up to Ellis Island were somewhat more educated and ready to fit the society. I think what we're getting with the refugee program is people that are not ready to fit in. They haven't got an education. They don't have a trade. Got a lot of kids. That's the talk of the town, is refugees.
And that's okay. You know, we understand that. Look, change is hard. On the other hand, three former refugees decided to run for office. So we go back and we document the first ever Bhutanese American in the history of the United States to ever run for anything. He lost by over a dozen votes.
Well, let's hear some of these voices. I mean, I think you've got Clarkston. The short story is, you know, once it was 90% white just 30 years ago. Now, whites make up less than 20% of the city's population. And the individuals who you describe, who've become part of this new story of America's diversity on steroids, are participating in politics. Here's Ibrahim Sufi, who's that former mayoral candidate.
City government hasn't built the relationships with the community. They haven't tried. And if they've tried, it hasn't worked.
And he's joined by Ahmed Hassan, who's a Somali-American member of the Clarkston, Georgia City Council.
People never had somebody that goes to their home and educate them what's going on in the city, what's needed to be done.
So is this a collision that's taking place in Clarkston, or are we seeing an assimilation, a melting, a coming together?
It's definitely not a collision. Right now, people of Clarkston are realizing that they have a pretty amazing and unique American story. You know, John, what's fascinating about Clarkston is the number of people who are actually involved. So they go to the town hall meetings. They go to the city council meetings. This past election, we saw the highest voter turnout. It still wasn't great, but it was the highest voter turnout of any recent election, the time that the three former refugees ran for office. But, you know, people are getting along. And what I love is the complexity. So when we were there documenting the last election for the city council and mayoral office, a woman came out of her car. She appeared to be a Vietnamese former refugee, a voter. And I thought in my mind that she was going to say, well, I'm going to vote for the former refugees because, you know, I want to support kind of where I came from. She was like, oh, no, I'm not voting for any of the former refugees. I'm voting for the most conservative guy. I'm voting for the white guy who's running because I don't trust them. I don't know what their religious backgrounds are. And it was like, okay. So if we think that this demographic change necessarily portrays a kind of a voter of the future, we don't know what that voter of the future is. And that's one of the dynamic things that we're witnessing in Clarkston. And that I think that they also realize this is a pretty unique story of American democracy as it is unfolding now in the modern America.
Unique in a sense, but also I think a lot of these number-driven uncertainties are exactly what's going on in places like Ferguson and other communities around the United States, where the number-changing demographics have fueled a kind of fear and uncertainty among certain groups, and that's expressed in politics and sometimes is expressed in unrest and violence on the streets.
Right. So, you know, for example, during the first 10 years of the 21st century, the U.S. population grew by 9.7%. Of that 9.7%, people of color accounted for 91.7% of that growth. So I think, John, unfortunately, that something that has happened is that in a mainstream American media that is in and of itself not diverse, then the story of change and diversity is told through a certain perspective. And I think sometimes that perspective is one of, uh-oh, this is scary. Wait a second. Change is coming. Wait. That means that what's going to happen to us? I'm not saying that that happens all the time, but in my experience in the many, many, many newsrooms that I have worked in that were essentially not diverse, there is a kind of approaching this story of demographic change with a sense of, oh, and What we're saying is it's already here. This series, America by the Numbers, is really about taking a mirror and putting it up to ourselves and looking at ourselves for who we really are. So why are you going to fear an America that is coming when that America is already here?
So many stories, the numbers really reflected in so many faces and voices around the United States. Maria Hinojosa is the anchor and executive producer of America by the Numbers. The series premieres on the World Channel tonight. The series will also air on PBS beginning this Saturday. Maria, thanks so much.
Good to talk to you, John. Thanks.
It took me 4 days to hitchhike from Saginaw. I've come to look for America.
Where do you look for America? Tell us a story of diversity and change in your community. Check us out at thetakeaway.org or call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Be careful, his bow tie is really a camera.
The Takeaway is supported by Moo.com, offering business cards with Printfinity, the option for a different image on every card in a pack. More at Moo.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
PRI, Public Radio International.